Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope everyone had a great weekend and are enjoying these bonus daily episodes. Heard it before, you'll hear it again through the end of the year and the kind of start of the holiday break. Today's episode is part of The Realignment's daily series covering the big themes and topics that drove 2022. If you're enjoying the daily episodes and would like to support the work the team is putting in this month, go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link at the top of the show notes where you could subscribe for a monthly, yearly, or lifetime membership. Today's episode is all about the topic of work, especially after the recent layoffs across the tech industry and the growing sense that the window of opportunity opened by COVID, at least for white-collar workers, is coming to a close, with debates about remote work coming to an end and the office making a full return in 2023. I've got the perfect guest with Paul Millard, who I recorded a deep end episode with earlier in the year. Paul's the author of The Pathless Path, Imagining a New Story for Work and Life. Can't recommend it enough. It's available everywhere you can find your books, including Audible. Since we both live in Austin, I got the chance to record this one in person. Shout out to Permanent RCRD Studios. Can't recommend recording live there enough if you're in Austin. I'm looking forward to doing more of this in person next year. Huge thanks to Lincoln Network for supporting the show. I will see you all tomorrow. Paul Millard, welcome to The Realignment.
Excited to be here, Marshall.
Yeah, excited to be here in person. We're in Austin. It's exhausting doing these on Zoom, and it's a lot easier to be a little more dynamic and engaging in person. So here's the broad readout of the frame of the topic we're going to discuss today, work. The focus here is obviously during the daily episode series, so we're going to review 2022, but also your thoughts moving forward. A good way to kind of introduce yourself to the audience is to kind of talk about your book for a second. Your book is called The Pathless Path, Imagining a New Story for Work and Life. What is this pathless path and what kind of got you there as a framework?
Yeah, so I followed a more traditional career path after college. I worked for GE after college, broke into strategy consulting and stayed in that world for 9 years, ended up going to business school. I never really found a home where I felt like connected to the work and saw a future, like I want to be doing this 30 years from now. Eventually walked away from that path. Took a leap to become self-employed. And as soon as that happened, I just felt like things were off. Like I was totally unprepared in a very weird way for the reality I now inhabited as a self-employed person. And I started just thinking about work, writing about work, doing experiments on my life and working in different ways and talking to literally hundreds of people. Kept doing that for years and it sort of just emerged into a book. And my take, imagining a new story for work and life, was basically this hunch that a lot of people don't really feel like they fit in the current paradigm, but don't see any alternative.
What's interesting here is define the current paradigm, because as you know, you write about this topic, you're in the discourse. There's probably been four or five different paradigms since the early 2010s, social media definitely played a role in this. So what would you say was the, let's say 2016, 2017, you've gone self-employed paradigm that you think folks probably didn't fit into?
I think I would even step back. And many people live out their lives mapping their actions to like stories in their head. I call these like scripts, default scripts, right? And the default script says you sort of just like do education when you're young and then you get a job, get a career and sort of just figure things out. There's not much more nuance in the story. And the reality is people are doing like many different things. There are so many different paths in today's world, but we're still sort of mapping it to that default path. I saw this, screenshot that was going around last week on social media about this guy who had worked in tech. He says, my net worth has been cut from $10 million to $5 million. $5 million to $2.5 million. $2.5 million net worth. One of the richest humans at the richest points in history, right? And he's like, I can't afford these $10 million homes. Like, I feel like I've been misled.
Like, 'cause he's walking around San Francisco. I think I saw this.
Yeah. Like, that's wild to me. Like, what is the story in his head that says, like, he's struggling and upset and not happy with how his life is turning out with such, like, dramatically positive outcomes?
I think the thing that, to speak up for our humble, mere 2.5 millionaire, the story he's probably been told is that work hard.
Yeah.
You go to a top-tier university. He worked at a, like, big tech company, so Meta, Facebook, Google, Amazon, one of those companies. And then looking at the way that things were supposed to progress, that $10 million would make a lot of sense. So what do you think is off about that story?
Yeah, I think things have changed, right? The economy has slowed. You've talked about this with, like, Eric Weinstein, right? He's talked about how, like, the economic growth rates have slowed. But, like, institutions are still mapping their ideas of, like, how the economy works to those previous growth rates, right? And financialization and things like that have sort of, like, made the system a little weirder. Essentially, like, I think these things are really simple. Like, people want to buy the home they think they deserve where they want to live. And because of the way the economy has shifted, like, people at the higher end of the income spectrum are getting outsized income returns, but, like, aren't able to actually just solve that basic desire. And that just makes people feel unsettled.
Yeah.
Right. But it's sort of like this red queen race of, like, people, the stakes just keep getting raised and raised.
Can you explain the red
queen
idea?
Yeah. So the idea is that, like, your expectations creep up. I'm probably not going to do a good job explaining this, but the expectations creep up and then they just keep creeping up further and further because they're creeping up, right? It's sort of this, like, vicious cycle of things get more and more. Like, the median home in the US right now is something like 2,700 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that houses less people with 1,000 more square feet on average than it did like 30 years ago. Right. But it to people, it doesn't seem like they can buy a smaller home and feel like a successful person, a successful adult. Right. And that's where the disconnect comes from. And the path out of this, I think, isn't to, like, blame capitalism, blame society, blame our political leaders. It's like, it's really simple, I think, which is basically like accepting a new story. And, like, I think what's happening, and which has been accelerated out of the pandemic, is the pieces of this new story are emerging. I don't know what it's going to look like. I just have a deep sense it is emerging and evolving.
I want to get into the elements you see emerging, but quick note of pushback, I think the fair way to articulate the, like, capitalism pushback is that under a liberal, democratic, like, Western mindset, we're going to focus all the attention on the individual. So we'd say, hey, Paul, are you unhappy? Are things not going well for you? Don't ask yourself, well, how has my boss structured the company? Don't ask yourself, what tax policies are politicians imposing? How are we investing in various things that can make life better? Instead, it's up to you to come up with, like, your own way to cope with the new story. So what would your response be to that end?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think, like, this podcast you run with Sagar is one of the best, like, lenses I have into politics. Because I love when you push back on people on this show. Like, you're like, well, actually, this stuff does matter and people should think about it. And I think that's a huge point. And I think, like, what I would say to people is, like, we need to accept, like, what is actually happening, right? And understanding these things can help. Right. As a self-employed person, the political and labor economy is not set up to, like, optimize around my success unless I'm succeeding at, like, the extreme wealth levels. Like, it's optimized around full-time workers.
Yeah. Explain. Right? Can you help us understand this? Because this is, I think, going to be helpful for people. You're not, like, a small business owner. you're self-employed, you're not full-time. Like, what are these different categories we should be thinking of?
Yeah, so you have full-time workers, right? So like, and I think this is an interesting thing to dive into. A lot of people traditionally think of like the managerial class and the labor class, right? We actually have a few different classes. We have like the working class, which might be like manufacturing workers, people who are working in a very specific domain and they can like organize around their labor. That has become less and less an element of the U.S. labor economy, right? And then you have like the owners, the capitalists. Sure, those have been consistent, probably growing over time. But then there's like the professional managerial class. And the mistake people always make when they assess like what's happening in work is that they assume the professional managerial class is opposed to the owners, the capital, right? And
depends if you're looking at Elon Musk's Twitter. There's definitely an element going on there.
Yeah, and I mean that's like culture war stuff. But
you mean good point. At an economic level,
yeah,
that's the key thing. Salaries, benefits, yeah.
Yeah, and in the 60s and 70s, people were writing about this. Like, this new professional managerial class, knowledge workers, were tangential to these worlds. They see themselves as future capital owners, right? They don't see themselves as opposed. They're like fully ingrained into these companies, into these mindsets. And the interesting lens I see is like these people are committed to a story of a career, right? They're not actually committed to a company anymore, but they are committed to a narrative, a conception of a certain way of orienting towards life that says like work is the center. I'm going to dedicate to my career. And I think what's happened is like the returns on that just aren't what they were like with the story we've inherited. Like my father has a pension from like committing himself to a company and it sort of paid off. Every year that pays off less and less. And which means you have to put more and more attention on that like individual relationship to career, which just increases anxiety.
Yeah, let's play with this for a second because I've never heard this articulated this way. So we all know the convention. It's conventional wisdom because it's true and it's helpful. Peak 1950s, you go to GE, you go to Ford, you go to GM, they're going to have your back for the long term, a little less control, but that's the trade-off. The point that I think PMCs and our infamous 2.5 millionaire at a FANG company, they give up that guarantee of a pension, but they were supposed to get more autonomy, more freedom. You are suggesting that narrative, actually, this is actually the helpful part, because just to kind of correct myself, when we kind of tell this story, we say that PMC workers got this new option, which is I'm Marshall. I could go work at Hudson, then I'll go work at OnDeck, then I'll go work on the realignment. And honestly, I'm more committed to being a content creator than I am to any of these companies, but that's awesome. And the tragedy of our economy is that working class people and those GE laborers didn't actually get that new opportunity that I have. Are you suggesting that this new story that I just told isn't as satisfying or maximizing as people think it is?
Yeah, right. So if we were to give you the option, or many knowledge workers now, the option of like going back in time and committing to one company for their entire life, they probably wouldn't take it, and probably smartly so, because there were costs with that. Like people really subsume their identity into these company man type archetypes, right? Even like our generation saw it with our parents, many such cases, right? So a lot of people wouldn't opt into that, right? But we don't fully acknowledge the costs of that. What are the costs of that? It means you have to basically manage your entire career yourself. Instead of like a company taking care of it, like you're in charge, which just increases the variability, like the range of outcomes and things like that. I think the interesting thing about self-employment is like you are painfully aware of the costs, right? And I think one of the great things for me is like I sort of priced in those costs that were ignored on a career path. I think there is this sort of like silent conspiracy in the career world to basically ignore all these underlying anxieties and costs and pressures because everyone's experiencing it. It's like, if you don't talk about it, I won't talk about it. But then I quit my job and I'm like, Oh my gosh.
Like, what are some examples of that?
I have to figure everything out. Well, I have to like make money. I have to figure out my own taxes. I have to figure out my own healthcare.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't keep doing stuff, I don't make money. Right? I don't have a boss to complain to. I think just that disconnect from like having a boss to complain to. So like not everyone can take this self-employed path, but like the reality of many knowledge work paths now is they are self-employed. They just happen to be working at multiple companies, right? So like what I'm sort of arguing in my book, in my writing, is that everyone is on a pathless path, and it might be more beneficial to at least accept some of the paradigms of thinking of yourself as self-employed. Now, is that optimal at a societal and cultural level to organize society around this? Maybe not.
Because like you said, we haven't structured our society to advantage this style of employment.
Well, nobody's structuring society, right?
Well, but you said for full-time employees.
Yeah. Right. The incentives are around full-time employment. And this is always the interesting thing. You see like politicians who have never taken a gap in employment or a day off in their careers, like proposing things like portable benefits. That is very much a full-time workers' conception of like what we should do for gig workers and self-employed workers, right? But like a lot of self-employed workers are like accepting all those costs, right? They don't want smoothed out wages. Like they're accepting, will people take that? Sure. Will it win votes? Maybe. But like, that's not actually what people want.
Wait, let me pause because I want to explore this a bit. So when you're referring to portable benefits, obviously we're talking about healthcare. We're talking about like other various forms of like traditionally like employer given benefits to employees. And what people argue when they support these policies, they say, hey, Paul, you only stuck around GE so long because you really needed healthcare that year. What if your healthcare were portable? Maybe you could have been following your new path earlier. Maybe you could have started a business. Like what explain then within, I guess, how I just set it up, like what we're missing when we tell that story.
Yeah. I have a hunch that the way we're setting up healthcare is destructive for innovation and creativity in our economy. Mm-hmm. Right. I think a lot of people have this hunch. So that's like, should people be able to like move jobs more easily, like go on their own more easily and have healthcare coverage? Sure. What I'm talking about is like, politicians are basically seeing like a rise of independent workers and they're saying like, okay, how can we win over this class of people to win votes? Right? Okay. That's like a political problem, right? And they're coming up with ideas like portable benefits, right? I don't think that gets to the root cause of like solving the underlying problems. I don't even know what people are solving for other than coming up with like shiny objects to like try and win new classes of and blocks of voters, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not like super deep on that, but stepping back too, I think tying back to our previous point, David Autor, are you aware of his research?
Yeah.
He's from MIT. He has basically shown what's happening to the economy, which is a disappearance of what he calls middle skilled jobs. And so our labor economy has bifurcated into an increase in lower income jobs and an increase in higher income jobs. You never hear about that, the increase in higher income jobs, because it doesn't fit an inequality narrative. Mm-hmm. But it just means it's harder, right? Higher skilled jobs mean like you need to be like a highly trained person. You need to be like managing your energy, your health, like all these things. And that's intense, right? And if basically David Autor in his speech, where he talks about this research, he's like, these middle skilled jobs were like comfortable jobs at big companies with pensions and benefits. Those are just decreasing. So like people rightly are like a little more anxious, a little more insecure, a little more upset with their relationship to work.
Do we know why they're decreasing?
I'm not too sure. I think there's a couple things. I think there was, so Autor talked about this interesting trend of like people used to be able to move to cities and it would be like an increase in a wage premium, mm-hmm. right? So like people could move from rural areas to urban areas for a wage premium. But also there were bountiful like middle skill jobs in across all parts of America too. Basically, a lot of those jobs have come to cities now, working for like big knowledge firm type jobs. You can get a cozy job working for like a big company in a city, right? But the costs have increased as well. But if you're that person in random city in America, like that job isn't there anymore. It's that middle skill job at a random company that was in the suburbs is now like, okay, you might have to do retail plus gig work plus things like that.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that resentment and anger has been pretty well represented and captured by like what the Republican Party is trying to do sometimes.
Yeah. I want to go back to an earlier episode, especially because you worked at GE. I had a reporter from the New York Times, David Gellies, on talk about a book about like Jack Welch and capitalism. We had a sidebar about different eras producing different style of like career and business discourse. I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts on this. So basically to introduce this to you and for folks who might not have listened to the episode, we were talking about Jack Welch, GE CEO, famous obviously, management books in the 1990s being just like peak airport
so big.
Book. Like Michael Scott famously, if you watch early episodes of The Office, like he has he has his Trump book obviously because it was the, you know, NBC mid-2000s, but there's a Jack Welch book and those books are all about like managing. And David and I were talking about how if you go to the airport now, very few management books. Like you're seeing yourself as this person who's this like manager, like that's your value. Instead, business books, the airport sense, tend to be focused on like individual skill development, tuning. I'd love to hear just like your response to just like this framework. Cause you see it the second you remember, like my dad had a small business growing up. And when I went back home to Oregon during the summer, they just had all these 90s like management books. And I just know that if my dad were, let's say, in his 30s today, those books would be more like productivity. They'd be kind of the Adam, you know, like Gantt style stuff. So what is your thought about this framework?
Yeah, I think it's spot on. It was interesting when I got a job at GE. I wanted to work in strategy consulting, but all the adults around me didn't know what consulting firms were. Mm-hmm. Like I ended up getting a job at McKinsey after GE and like my parents would call it like McKenzie, right?
McKenzie. That's funny.
But the glow of like the boomers when I got a job at GE was like, oh, you've made it.
Yeah.
You've got it all set. And then the lived reality of working there was like, what has gone wrong? It was just like the ghost of industrial past. Mm-hmm. This was like clearly a thriving place 20, 30 years ago. But like I was working with people in their 50s who were like totally uninterested in working. I had my first rotation in this GE program was worked with this like group of older men. They had like hidden out in a bunker. I was working at the factory in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. They were hidden out in like the sub bunker, which was like built for nuclear war era to like protect engine manufacturing. And they were just in this abandoned room by themselves, like three guys. Basically, the joke was like they didn't really do anything. They just like hung out there and like I had to like take 20-minute walks down this like corridor in the basement to go to them and then walk back. And like everything just seemed built around like doing as little as possible just to like make it to retirement, get those pensions. Like,
yeah.
And so it's like very clear to me like this era was over. I needed to move on. But like and it was all like – as soon as I went to work at a place like McKinsey, it all was about your own career narrative instead of like what you do for the company. At GE, it was like, here's what you do to succeed here. There was like this stigma against thinking about working elsewhere or leaving.
Yeah.
You can't talk about that here. What do you mean? Then you go to a place like
McKinsey. The implication of it.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you want to succeed at GE? Yeah. My HR person, when I left GE, she was like, why would you leave? This is such a good opportunity. Like, this will probably look bad on your career.
Which is just funny in retrospect. No, who? Oh, great. GE, McKinsey, business school. This all makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, I was leaving GE to go to McKinsey, and she's like, this is a really bad decision. It was just this idea that, like, you go to one company and stay there. But when I got to McKinsey, like, I was like, this is great. I'm going to, like, chill here for a while. Everyone there was focused on the next step. And this is something I write about in my book is, like, I sort of realized, oh, wow, like, people are like unhappy here in like a, I need to keep progressing my career. I need to make more money. I thought I had like made it. I was like very happy there. The perks were incredible. Like people treated you really well. The mentorship was amazing. And people are like, how are we going to get into business school? How are we going to like get this future job? It was all about just the next step and the next step and the next step. And like, that's when I started getting into like productivity stuff, self-improvement stuff, because like that's what everyone was doing. Everyone was trying to better themselves. But the dark side of that is like there's this entire class of people that are constantly worried about career progress. And there's just this anxiety.
And a key thing, they're worried about career progress in a deeply amorphous way. So yeah. Like let's say at GE, there's, okay, so if I do it's my time on this rotation, I'll go there. And you're stressed about your performance, but that's different versus, okay, so like I'm in a McKinsey office, but oh, like it's the DC office. So it's a second tier office relative to like the New York office. And how am I, it's amorphous. And how's business school going to think about that? Oh man, like, is this in the T15? It's a totally, and once again, it sounds like we're just whining about like upper middle class stuff, but it's just interesting the like different mental frame that you're approaching within these systems.
Well, I think just far more people in America have like jumped into this like upper middle class segment. Like that has grown substantially and just doesn't get talked about a lot. The economic data is pretty clear though. And meaning like there's those people that are sort of making it work, and there's the people like right below that that are also like aiming at that ideal of a life.
Yeah.
Too.
So this is also helpful too, because if you're thinking about, let's say there are plenty of people, especially in like superstar cities. So like New York City, Los Angeles, where people aren't actually making six figures.
Yeah.
Think of people in like media, television, entry-level analysts, a lot of these firms, like they're making 40, 50, 60, 80, 90. That's not an upper middle class wage, but their careers are premised on when I'm in my 30s, post-business school, post this or that, like credentialing institution, then I'll kind of be there. So they're behaving as if they are, even though they're not quite. That's where the term is Henry, like high income, rich yet.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
High earner, not rich yet.
And I was always confused. Like, I grew up pretty humbly. And like, when I made six figures for the first time, I was like, this is great. And then everyone around me is like, we're so poor. We're struggling. And I realized now, like, it wasn't actually about the money. It was really about the status. Right. And what
you're missing the point if you think it's about, you know, the pure guys, look at these spreadsheets, like compared to human history, look at this. And it's like, no,
that was like what I was doing. And I was like, I'm pretty happy. This is great. And like people would say things like, oh, I can never afford to have kids. And I'm like doing the math. I'm like a little too analytical and like numbers. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like my parents did this on one income when my dad was working an hourly job. Like, this should work. This should be possible.
Yeah.
But what they're really saying is I can't raise the kids in the way I want to, which is like private school, this elite life, having to not worry about money, be able to just buy whatever I want, right? And that's like a whole new thing. Like, that is just like the creeping expectations of like what a successful life looks like. And this is a script many people have, like, as they start college, like, this idea of, like, you go to college and you'll be set. It's creeped up. It's no longer, like, go get a job at GE. Mm-hmm. Like, even at my school, like, which is probably similar to Oregon, I went to University of Connecticut. Like, good state schools, not, like, the top tier. There's, like, some good opportunities at top companies, but, like, you probably a lot of, like, Oregon companies, probably a lot of people work at Nike. A
lot of Nike.
Right. But like they see now more paths, more prestigious things, and they want that too. So mm-hmm. There's just mass swelling of like hyper educated people. And I don't really know the answer for all this. Like, this is just really hard. And like what I'm saying to like some people who might be like hyper curious and have some itch to like create stuff on their own is like, there's actually this arbitrage opportunity right now. If you're willing to pay the status cost, which was basically like me walking away and people being like, why would you walk away from such guaranteed income?
Because you took an income cut. Like that's the key thing.
Yeah. The first 4 years of self-employment, I made 45 grand, 35 grand, 32 grand, and then 50 grand.
That's a cut. That's a cut from post MBA.
Yeah.
You know, McKinsey world.
Yeah. I pretty much like broke even for like 4 years. And that's like crazy to people because early 30s, like max income years. I tried to calculate this once and it was like, I probably missed out on like $1 million of earnings. But like, what's the point? Like, if you have no time, what's the soul cost? Like, and I just felt like I was totally on the wrong path and like not actually wired for the world I was succeeding in. It was like play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
And what is the stupid prize in the case? So let's say you'd never left. Like, what was the stupid prize you would have gotten?
A life built around work. Like, I didn't, I didn't want that. The thing is, like, it's sort of this trap because if you stay in these firms, everyone increasingly defines their life around work. I had this thought the other day that, like, on the default path, in a traditional path of work, people sort around income. Mm-hmm. On the pathless path, people sort around interest. Right? So, like, why am I in Austin? Because I can align around other people that have similar interests. And it happens the city is sort of built around letting people cohabitate at different income levels.
Explain that. As someone who just got here.
Yeah. So we're 10 minutes out of downtown. You can afford a decent house here on like a decent income. Like, well, real estate prices got out of control, but they're dropping. They're dropping fast.
You and I, as former East Coasters, can be very precise when we say this.
Yeah,
Austin is way more expensive than it used to be. When we're comparing this to New York,
yeah,
where there is just no presumption that you're getting a home.
Well,
real estate in the same way in that place that does not exist here in Austin to the same degree.
I think a lot of the U.S. is like this.
Really,
because. Like, homes are pretty affordable in most of the U.S. Like, things got out of control in the last 2 years. That's probably going to correct a little. But, like, a lot of our consciousness of, like, how we think about these things and how the professional managerial class thinks about these things is, like, filtered through a New York way of thinking around the world. Mm-hmm. Which is just, like, New York is a crazy place to live and work. Like, and we just have all our media and news there. Like, filtering it through this lens of, like, money is the problem to be solved, right?
So how, where are you on the remote work narrative debate? Because the remote work propaganda is, now this no longer matters. Because if you could live anywhere, even New York isn't going to set the narrative expectation in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's, like, that narrative is nonsense, right? Because everyone knows if you're orienting your life around career and work, you still need to be in the mix.
You can't actually move to Tulsa.
You can move.
That's the secret.
You can move to Greenwich and the house is just inflated like 40, 50% in these like donuts, right? I think there's like this economist that called it like the donut effect. Basically, mm-hmm. The donuts around these urban centers have like dramatically inflated in price. For people like us, we probably can have more flexibility. On independent paths working for ourselves. I think over the long run, there will be some sorting out and like maybe new smaller cities and hubs and nodes that do emerge. That's just going to continue to happen. That's inevitable with the internet. Mm-hmm. But in the current paradigm, if you're like serious about your career, like sure, you can live an hour outside of San Fran, but you still got to show up there. You can't go live in like Joshua Tree unless you're like, have some leverage later points in your career. And like companies are clamping down on this too. Like they're not letting people go live in Mexico City. They're like making sure people still live in the US.
That dream died. There was a hot moment last year, but it seems like that dream.
Yeah. That's HR was like, oh, there's tax implications of this.
where do you kind of stand on the remote work debate in terms of like whether or not like remote work works, quote unquote, because it just seems to me, once again, you and I have benefited from the fact that, I mean, self-employed. That being said, like I'm able to move to Austin because I'm like, look, like it's still cheaper to live here and then hop on a flight to New York two times a quarter than actually just still live in New York full time. But it just seems to me just perceiving people and institutions like the remote thing is not working particularly well.
I would push back on that. I think that is too broad of a frame. I think these decisions are happening at the individual level. So I wrote a part of a like book with Holloway around remote work. There are many companies that are thriving working remotely. Can it work if you go from like a 30,000 person in-person company to a 30,000 person remote company? That is really hard. Companies have struggled to change and pivot in many times over the past 50, 70 years.
Strategy consultant.
Right, yeah. Just tons of failures. So like, can companies shift? I don't know. But as a starting condition, it's just a different constraint. I think what we're seeing is basically more ways of thinking about structuring a company than ever before, which is good for the economy as a whole. Adds increasing complexity for an individual though, right? So there's no debate, right? There are remote companies and there are fully in-person companies. And there's a full range of companies in between now. Mm-hmm. And that's not going away. Companies are still going to make those decisions. If I think I can outcompete a company by going remote first, and a lot of companies do this early in their stage because it gives them more flexibility and lower cost structure, companies are definitely going to do that because the stigma of doing that is gone now.
Yeah.
So I would see remote is going to just get better and better because companies and people are going to learn how to do it. But it's a different
constraint. And
they're going
to sort more effectively into appropriate usage.
Yeah. But as an individual, you now need to decide, am I wired for remote work? Am I wired for in-person? What are my skills? What are my trade-offs? What are the opportunities? What does this mean for my career? It's just like another variable to think about, which is just like crazy as an individual. Mm-hmm. Like the whole debate is just like a media thing that gets people to click. Like the companies are already like deciding, right? Like Twitter going in person, sure, that's just like an individual company deciding that. Like, yeah. Other companies, if they think they can compete more effectively, will go remote first. And like the market will sort that out.
So it seems like the critique you're making is that too often the front-facing remote work versus in-person debate is too ideological. When it actually comes down to it, it's just going to be a business decision.
The default of working now is hybrid. And like just nobody wants to say this yet.
Yeah.
I don't know because—
There are no take points.
Yeah.
It sounds mushy.
It's just kind of boring.
Yeah.
Castle Systems has this report of like, basically they're like a key fob company and they have a report on like when people are coming to work. Essentially what they're showing is people are coming Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, like no one's coming.
Don't send emails on Friday is the big lesson I've learned.
Friday is like a default remote day now.
Yeah.
Which essentially the market has decided that we now have a 4-day work week. And this is the thing that no one's talking about is like, we have a 4-day work week for knowledge workers. Monday is sort of like a flex day. Maybe you come in, maybe you don't. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you're coming into an office. This is like more than half of the people are coming into the office. And then like Fridays are like whatever it is. And like, and it's weird. Like, I think the way we talk about work is just so weighted. We map so many emotions around like what's good, what's right, what's moral, what's just to work. And like really people are just like doing stuff for companies, right? And it's sort of just like redistribution of wealth to workers.
Mm-hmm. Something I'd love to talk a bit about, we were discussing this before we started recording the episode, is there have been different, very 2010 style to stick in the theme of the Noah Smith episode I just did around how the 2010s produced a variety of like philosophies and thoughts. I'd love to go through some of the thinkers that you've been thinking a lot about their work and how like your kind of philosophy around the default path fits into it. So we've got obviously Tim Ferriss, there's Eric Weinstein, like you mentioned earlier, there's Helen Peterson has been on the podcast before. We'd just love to hear like your big readout on big authors, bodies of intellectual work that listeners have probably like heard about and definitely seen at the airport bookstore.
Yeah. So I had this article I wrote early on in my journey called The Five Conversations of Work. And I'm probably going to get these wrong reflecting back, but I was basically sort of looking at this and like people are talking about radically different things, right? There's like how organizations are transforming. That's one conversation. The other is like the gig economy and how individuals are changing their relationship to work. Another is like this personal development, succeed. Another one is like this career mindset. And then there's sort of a fifth, like deeper one, which is like a philosophical pushback against work. So like I can go through some of those quickly, like the Ann Helen Peterson, like Charlie Wartzel take on work is like sort of like they're correctly calling out like people are more anxious, people are more stressed, people having to manage all these things. Some of the things are unfair. They often conclude that like capitalism is to blame, hypercapitalism. And sure, there's there's some truth in that. This is what the system is producing. But like there's no next step other than like overthrow the government and like install a new political system, right? So it's not an empowering script. It's not inspiring. It gets clicks and shares because people are like, hell yeah, I feel like this and I resonate and I vibe with like what they're writing, but there's no actionable to-do list, right? Tim Ferriss, I think, is totally underrated still. He gets sort of like mischaracterized as like this hack work. At core in his book, if you read, he is making a...
This is 4-hour work
week. Yeah, 4-hour work
2007, week. The OG
yeah.
of the don't think of yourself as a future Jack Welch, think of yourself as an individual kind yeah. of genre switch.
He walked so I could run. So thank you, Tim Ferriss. But in his book is a strong philosophical argument, which is like this deal, this social contract we think we're getting isn't true anymore. Take things into your own hands. Now, where he and I depart is he is taking a like hack things, make enough money so you can escape the system, right? Mine is more like...
So to give an example, like it's kind of... Can you give some examples of
yeah,
like,
because yeah.
it's been a while. I mean, the book's from 2007. So like, what's the...
Yeah. So he makes arguments like, okay, what we're making all this money so we can retire in the future and live our like quote unquote rich life in the future. What is our rich life now? And does it really take money to live that life? Right. It's sort of a refactoring of like, what do we really want out of life? His path and framework is built around like what he's good at. Like, optimizing things, scaling things, automating things, things like that, which is like, he's like hire assistants, automate tasks. And like, this has become a lot more normal. Like
yeah.
I'm sure both of us have like automated bots and software doing stuff for
aspirationally,
us.
But thought about it.
but yeah. And where I differ is like, that is like Tim Ferriss's wiring. I'm not actually wired like him. Mm-hmm. I'm a little lazier and stubborn in the sense that like I actually want to do things I like doing. And Tim Ferriss has kind of landed in the same frame, which is like I went a little hard. I was probably dealing with some trauma from childhood and things like that. It's actually about like just finding the long games you want to commit to. But if you read in history, like this is what everyone writes about. This is like Thoreau, Susan B. Anthony, like people back as far as you can remember, it's like once you find the work that matters to you, you can design a life around continuing to do that. Finding a relationship with things that light you up is like something, though, I don't think you can expect to get paid for, right? Writing is something that is like sacred to me and I love. Now, I've made 98% of the income from writing only in the last year.
So it's after what, 7 years?
Yeah, and I've been writing for fun before that as well. But like, I don't know what my book's going to do next year. I'm like totally honored that I've made some money from the book. I don't know what it's going to do next year. I want to continue to write and I want to build a life around that.
Yeah.
I'm willing to fight for it and make money in other ways. But I think that that's a total refactoring of like what the point of life is. If you base it on people's actions, people say the point of life is basically to work, which is like, do you want to spend time together? I can't. I need to take days off, mm-hmm. right? Why don't you do this thing you care about? Well, I can't. I'm too busy. I have stuff going on, right? And that's just the reality. That's the soup we live in. So that's sort of my framing. I think there are other frames too. There are like thought leaders like Adam Grant and like Jacob Morgan. And they're like thought leaders that like map to what the corporate world wants. Like they're both like full-time workers basically, but like, especially Adam Grant, like he
professor. Yeah.
Yeah. He crushed it on the traditional path, but he works all the time and he orients his life around things and he gets a lot of satisfaction around it because he gets a lot of joy out of like mentoring students and like working with students. Being a professor is pretty cool if you can like make it and have tenure.
Yeah. The complicated part. Nice job if you can get it.
But I don't really find much takeaways from his ideas anymore because a lot of it's like, okay, craft your job within a job container. And if you edit these things or like change your mindset around these things in a job container, you can thrive. And potentially my research shows you get paid a little more by doing this. It's like, he's not questioning it at a philosophical level. He's just saying like a job and working for a company is part of your life.
Mm-hmm. So it's not, and this is actually helpful with not your critique of Tim Ferriss, but why you find the Tim Ferriss thought lacking in this moment is if Tim's like hacking the specific things, you know, Adam's kind of turning dials in different degrees and you could get like, 2, 3, 4, 5%. And that does mean something, but that seems to miss. Oh, this is actually good. If the critique of, you know, Annie and Charlie Roselle is that, you know, they're diagnosing how people don't feel satisfied right now.
Yeah,
so they're not actually offering anything. Adam's thought is not actually going to address that deep dissatisfaction either.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty radical to question the underlying relationship with work. So like Andre Gorz is a sociologist. And then I think in the 90s, he was writing about work, his book called The Wage-Based Economy or something like that. And he's like, what dictates our membership in a society is paid employment. Paid employment is our way of participating in society. So that is a really interesting frame because if you're self-employed, you're not an active participant in society as we've constructed it. And this sort of explains a lot of the like weird reactions. Like my family will still be like, oh, Paul doesn't have a job. He doesn't work. Right. And what they're really saying is he's not relating to this society in the way I think is right and good.
Mm-hmm.
In the way I've sort of just accepted, right? And what I think is happening is more and more people, like from 2005 to 2015, like the growth of alternative work arrangements, I think Lawrence Katz and someone else wrote this, 100% of the growth in the labor economy was alternative work arrangements. We have this participation rate, but part of that participation rate is like people working for companies like Manpower, or other third-party contractors
mm-hmm.
for like Google, right? They're like working for these other companies, but they're sort of in a contract-like job. And that is just slowly becoming more and more as part of the economy. I think we're headed in a direction where that is going, like our weird paths are basically going to become the norm. They're already way more prevalent than people think. We just sort of only map our ideas of like, how life should work to like this really outdated idea of like the organization man.
Mm-hmm. So I guess as we're getting these last 10 minutes or so, I'd love to talk about another big idea that in a weird way kind of got at some of the themes you were talking about, which was the creator economy and this idea that participating in the creator economy. So that's creating content, writing, podcasting, artistry, there's this articulation of the bringing this creator middle class, like hypothetically 50 million Americans, was the Signal Fire put out a actual report, Josh Constein, and it specifically like put out that number. Where did the creator economy discourse kind of end up? Because I think the other thing that helpfully made creator economy stuff go big is it perfectly coincided as a tech category with remote work. And with COVID, so there was
an investment opportunity.
So yeah, I would love to get your big thoughts on that.
There is no creator economy.
We're creators, though. I mean, but this is where it's interesting.
Right. So like, what I'm saying is like, creator economy is a created concept by venture capitalists who needs stories around how you can invest and make money in this segment. Right? A lot of those companies just are really struggling to make money because the idea around VC is like capture the entire market. Basically, like what you realize when you're operating in this space, like a creator, like when I started in 2017, there was no term like creator economy.
Yeah.
You're dealing with all sorts of services and different things, and there isn't really like a single like thing you're doing. There was this article like, we need a middle class for a creator economy middle class, right? It was like an HBR article by like
Legion.
Yeah. It's a misconception of like how the world works. Like we're grasping at like returning those middle skill jobs David Autor is talking about.
Cause I want to, I want to put a pin on this because the point of the creator economy, like creator middle class is not, man, we're going to create 100x the number of Mr. Beasts and everyone's going to be crushing their YouTube rev. It's like, no, there could be a world. I think this is good, and I'll be sure to link to the piece. The idea is that there was an opportunity to say, hey, like a bunch more people can make 30, 40, 50, even making 10 to 15,000 on the creator economy. If you're in a solidly middle-class space, that's huge. Like that's a step up. That's what they were talking about, and you don't think that exists.
Well, the numbers say it doesn't exist. The average is probably making $0.
Yeah.
Right? But I think it's this continued misconception.
Wait, I keep interrupting just to make this, to make this difficult for you as an actual guest. I'm going to put on my like fake aspirational VC hat and say, you're right. People are making $0. That's because we don't have the right tools, which is why we're investing and I mean this. I'm saying in good faith, like why, like we need to invest in like actual tech that unlocks the opportunity there.
The tools are just going to make the Mr. Beast more dominant and successful. So a couple things here. One is just like we're misconceiving like what is happening. Like the U.S. economy is basically just like a free market, the labor economy. Right. And people are making different decisions and trade offs. Like we have more freedom in our labor market than most countries in the world. Mm-hmm. But we're looking at like this space, which like VCs have coined to like channel of investment opportunity is like, oh, we need to create jobs here. We should probably focus on creating like good full time jobs with decent salaries. Like, the problem to be solved is not to like turn everyone into an individual creator, right? And it misses the point that a lot of people get satisfaction out of creating online that can add meaning to their life. This totally gets ignored. I talk to people every day who are in jobs in different countries. Different countries is a huge underrated upside of the creator economy, who are like, oh my gosh, I can like share an article and find like three friends online. And this will get mocked by some people, but like it's very true. I'm very in the mix with these people. It's adding a lot of meaning to people's lives. My wife's doing stuff like this.
Yeah, and you spent most of COVID overseas.
Yeah. And you're connecting with people. Some of my best friends are in Poland, in India, in Taiwan, in Korea, like in different countries, because we connect over ideas. And some people do this stuff on the side for fun. And this might be something that leads into something. Maybe they take a leap and go all in 5 years from now, but it also could just be meaningful to them, mm-hmm. right? We have a political and labor economy set up around full-time jobs. Like we should probably focus on fixing the incentives there. Like, the dynamics of like what we're calling the creator economy are not really set up to like create jobs. But at the same time, Mr. Beast is hiring 25 people right now. Mm-hmm. This is the thing people are missing. Me and you will probably hire people in the future. You probably have people helping you out or working for you. Those, like, I have this idea that like basically the companies of the future are silly newsletters right now. Right. And we're just like pretending like we're at the like end of history at all times. This is the end of history illusion. Like things are going to change and evolve. The middle class of the creator economy is not a creator. The middle class of the creator economy in the future will be people working for Mr. Beast. Will be people working for people like David Perel, who's building what the future of a university is going to look like. Will be people working for you who is building what the future of a media enterprise looks like. It is so obvious to me that that will become true, even though like in the moment we feel like we're failing and we're struggling and we're still figuring it out. It's like very clear that's how the world is headed.
When did you start to figure that out? From your, let's just buy your viewpoint. When did you, like, when did you have that itch? Because the key thing is everyone who you just mentioned wasn't doing things before 2019.
Well, David was.
In the state, sorry, fair. He, like, rite of passage wasn't.
Mr. Beast was.
Fair. Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of people that are like, I interview people on my podcast, the Pathless Path podcast, which is very just like exploring people's paths. What you find is people have been actually in the creator economy their whole lives. Mm-hmm. I bet as a kid you were screwing around on the computer and doing stuff. We all were. And like we had been exploring, like channeling our desire to like connect around ideas, explore the internet, things like that for years. I had blogs, different things I tried over the years. It all makes sense now. So in some ways I've been doing this for 25 years.
Yeah.
Right. And now people are born with these tools and things. Like I was talking to somebody this morning from India. And he's working for somebody in the US. He's like volunteering to do videos with me. I'm like trying to pay him because I'm like, I got to pay you for this. It's awesome. He's like, no, I just want to like generously contribute. And like the long game is very clear for me. It became clear to me pretty early on my path, even though I had no proof. I wasn't making any money from it, but it was just like, there's a shift here. There's opportunity. And I have a certain set of skills like, hyper curiosity. I enjoy connecting with people and I love hanging out on the internet. And like for those kind of people, like it's a great time to be alive.
Let's close with this, especially because this is the 2022 end of year series. Like, what's your big piece of advice within your rewrite your scripts, get off the default path, framework for folks and listeners going into the new year during a time of like real economic precarity?
Yeah. So my advice is not to quit your job and do your own
especially
thing and follow
right now
my path. Well, for certain people, it's actually probably a great time. the advice I would give is like try to figure out what sort of like economic script reality you're swimming in, right? Try to get some sort of disconnection from the work you're doing, especially full-time workers. Like the smallest thing I have people do is like take an afternoon off secretly, just like block their calendar and go for a walk and wander without a destination. Change your relationship to how you're relating to the world. And like so many people in today's world, because of how the economy works, are trying to go through life with a clear direction and a clear destination in a world that doesn't have clear destinations. So the best way to deal with that is like go wander and go for a walk without a destination and see how that feels. Follow that feeling, follow that discomfort, see where it leads and start to do more experiments where you can disconnect from yourself as worker. We are not workers. We are humans with things to offer the world, things that matter to us. And it's worth finding those things.
That is an excellent place to leave things. Paul Miller, thank you for coming on The Realignment. And it's great to be here in Austin with you.
Thank you. So inspired by your path too. Keep going, man.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.